Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. America's ongoing immigration debate continues in the wake of two decisions by the Trump administration this month. The beginning of September, the administration announced its six-month phase-out of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals executive action, which would affect over 700,000 young people in this country. Then on Sunday, the administration announced the latest iteration of its travel and immigration ban, which would restrict travel to the United States by nearly all the citizens of Libya, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Somalia, Chad, and North Korea. In addition, some citizens of Venezuela and Iraq would face restrictions and heightened scrutiny. Sudan, which was on the previous versions of the list, was dropped. And unlike previous versions of the ban, this ban is set to be permanent. We'll discuss these issues, and the heart of our debate on immigration is Ali Noorani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum and author of There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. In it, he says the role of culture and values are the key issues in finding consensus positions towards continuing immigration, and advises engaging faith leaders, law enforcement, and business leaders to be the primary influence in convincing our political leaders to find a compromise and solution for both the Dreamers and the continuing plight of the estimated 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States. He'll be speaking on Beyond the Headlines, a conversation about immigration, tonight at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. That lecture is free to the public, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Ali Noorani, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Rich.
You know, the Trump administration's decision to gradually end the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, has created a new level of anxiety for these dreamers, as we call them, these young people affected by this decision. But, you know, I'm interested in your reaction to this. I mean, on one hand, yes, there's this issue, but all of a sudden, in reaction to the Trump administration's decision, you're hearing members of Congress who have previously seemingly been unwilling to consider any sort of path to citizenship for these young people, all of a sudden saying, we have to do something. What is your assessment of this decision? Is it a mixed bag or what exactly?
You know, at the end of the day, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that President Obama put into place in 2012 has been an incredibly important opportunity for about 740,000 young people and their families. It's created a wealth of opportunities and has, frankly, I think, continued to make it America a better and better place every day. So for President Trump to say, okay, I'm going to pull this program in 6 months, it has destabilized a lot of people's lives and destabilized a lot of workplaces. And I actually think that one of the most important impacts of the program, DACA as a program, has been for millions and millions of Americans. Because now millions and millions of Americans who've been here for generations realize that their kid's best friend is undocumented. The family one pew over at church is undocumented. The family down the street that they just enjoyed a barbecue with is undocumented. So while we are seeing greater support from across the political spectrum than ever for Dreamers, regardless of what happens with this legislation, those millions of Americans will never forget the fact that they know somebody who is undocumented. Which I think bodes well for having to, you know, the challenge of solving this problem in the years to come. But in Oklahoma in particular, we're incredibly grateful for Senator Lankford for taking a leadership role and really trying to find a constructive solution.
You may vary on this, but, you know, Senator Lankford probably might not have introduced that legislation with the previous president. I think it's the situation we're in now where they say, we can't deport 800,000. Essentially, culturally, these young people are Americans. Mm-hmm. Some of them don't even speak their home country language.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Senator Lankford is that as a House member, he was always in a constructive place on these questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a House member, he never really had an opportunity to take a vote and really play a leadership role. But you take a step back and you look at who he is as a person and his history and his experience as a youth minister, an active member of Southern Baptist life in the nation, much less Oklahoma. That, in my opinion, is a big reason why somebody like Senator Lankford sees a legislative solution for Dreamers, not just a question about politics or policy, but a question about culture and values and who he is as a person. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's the way that most Americans engage in the immigration debate, through their culture, through their values framework. It's not just about politics and policy.
Now, have you been heartened by some of the reactions you've heard on Capitol Hill since this decision? I mean, you've seen some people who have generally been fairly hostile to comprehensive immigration reform and probably hostile to the Obama administration's action as an executive action for DACA, all of a sudden saying, yes, we have to do something.
It is really nice to see for the first time in years where you have, you know, multiple pieces of legislation addressing this problem. You know, a number of them are bipartisan, a number of them are Republican only, a number of them are Democratic only. But everybody's rowing in the same direction, which I think bodes well not just for the challenge that this particular population has presented to policymakers, but for the challenge of American immigration overall. You know, that at its core is the fundamental question we face.
So it's one thing to have bills introduced in Congress. It's another thing altogether to get them through one house or two, both houses, and get to the president's desk for a signature. What is your assessment of where we are today?
Well, I think what we're going to see in the next 6 months is that, you know, more and more Republicans are going to be coming to the SUCCEED Act that Senator Lankford and Tillers have introduced this week. And that'll be good. But you're going to see opponents like, let's just say, you know, Representative Congressman King from Iowa, you know, other members of, you know, potentially the Oklahoma delegation saying, you know what, I don't want, this is not the solution that I want. I want to see increased interior enforcement. I want to see a massive reduction in legal immigration. You know, at the end of the day, we need to keep the interests of the American worker and their family in mind. And the American worker and their families are served by Dreamers getting legal status, going down a long and arduous path to eventually be able to apply for citizenship. Creates hundreds of thousands of jobs, creates over $22 billion in federal tax revenue, $81 billion in GDP over 10 years. Those are real numbers that have a real impact on people's lives.
Yeah. And of course, when you sit down and talk to Dreamers, you know, they're fully invested in the American dream. I mean, going back to the acronym that we use for them, they want to go to college. They want to get a good job. They want to have a driver's license. I mean, at least DACA's allowed for some of these things to occur through the deferred action.
So, I mean, this is the funny thing about the American dream. The American dream is important to the immigrant, but it's also important to the American. And sometimes in this debate, we have a tendency to kind of skip over that. You know, last year, as I was researching my book, I began to understand in a much deeper way the fears that Americans have for their future, more specifically, the future of their children. And, you know, candidate Trump, he led a number of people to believe that immigration was bad for their version of the American dream and their kid would not do better as a result. I think we now have an opportunity to make a case to the American public that the American who's been here for generations, their kids will do better than them just as much as Dreamers will continue to thrive if we pass legislation like the Dream Act.
Of course, for a good portion of this population that's been here for generations, they've seen, especially those who have not had their kids go to college, the idea of graduating high school or even maybe leaving high school and going to a manufacturing job, a job in mineral extraction, would be a coal mining or oil production. Those opportunities are not there the way they once were, and they see their kids and their lives not as good as their parents.
I mean, let's be honest. America is changing in every way we can imagine. You know, our demographics are changing, our economy is changing, and everything is becoming much less has become much less familiar. Even for, you know, myself, I've lived through a lot of these changes, but I still look ahead in 20 years and say, okay, what looms around the corner? And that's very scary for a lot of people. So, you know, the strategy that we use at the National Immigration Forum is really try to understand people's anxieties and what are they try to understand what they're afraid of, and then develop ways where we're working with their pastor, their police chief, a business owner in their community to create a constructive conversation. Because, like I said earlier, if we just approach immigration as a question of politics or policy, we're not answering the question that people have. Ultimately, it's a question about culture and values.
I know that's been the main focus of your book, There Goes the Neighborhood. And I think in some of your appearances, you've contrasted, going back to 2010, the LGBTQ's community's work for equal rights, starting with Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military. But again, it spread it to everything from, you know, marriage rights and everything else. And you contrast that with pro-immigration advocates' efforts to effect comprehensive immigration reform. What did one community get right and what did the other not get right?
So the book that I wrote starts on one particular day, December 18th, 2010. On that day in the morning, the DREAM Act was defeated. And in the afternoon, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. Now, organizationally, we didn't have the dog in the fight around Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I wanted to understand what was the campaign and the strategy that they ran within the Don't Ask, Don't Tell community. And what the case they made to the American public was, what does it mean to be able to serve your nation openly or freely? They never talked about politics. They never talked about policy. Those of us in the immigrant rights community and advocating the DREAM Act in 2010, we registered voters, we turned them out, and we made a case that Nevada and Colorado remained in Democratic hands because of Latino and Asian voters, which was true, but it was a political case that we made to the American public. We didn't win. In fact, we lost just hours before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. So I looked at that and said, okay, if we're going to really truly understand the tensions that are bubbling up in the Southeast, the Midwest, and the Mountain West regions of the country, we have to understand the folks who live there. We got to get out of our bubble. And, you know, the way that I've come to believe that our work needs to be done, and both organizationally and personally, is that we have to meet people where they are. We just can't leave them there. And that, as an organization, has really led us to a new strategy of engaging, you know, Bibles, badges, and business, as we come to say it.
Bibles, badges, and businesses.
And the theory there is that if you hold a Bible, you wear a badge, or you own a business, you want a common sense solution to the immigration system. And I hope the Oklahoma resident sees that phrase and says, I see myself in that phrase. I go to church every Sunday. I believe in national security. I believe in the power of business. So I'm going to listen to my pastor, my police chief, my business owner. You know, and it starts a very different conversation.
You've visited communities where, and you mentioned the Southern Baptist Conference and certain communities where you would think just at a glance that the community might not necessarily be open to a new group of immigrants moving into their community. I'm thinking Spartanburg, South Carolina. He said a lot of times these churches, especially even the Southern Baptist churches, mm-hmm. are doing a really incredible job of opening up their religious community, whether they're of that faith or not, but of being sort of an opening arm.
Exactly. And a place like South Carolina provides such a clear example in that, you know, this is a community that has gone tremendous economic change over the last 50 years. You know, and the way I wrote it is that as the textile mills moved to Mexico, Mexico moved to South Carolina, so that, you know, the state has seen the fastest growth in the Latino population, second only to North Carolina. And what we've seen, what I found in Spartanburg is the schools, elementary schools, adult education centers, you know, the principals, the, you know, First Baptist Church in Spartanburg, they were all employing a range of strategies to welcome and integrate immigrants and refugees into their institutions. Again, whether it was a First Southern Baptist Church or an elementary school. And there were a number of different ways they did that. And at the end of the day, their leadership firmly believed that Spartanburg was going to be better off as a result.
What was their impetus for doing that? Did they see that as for diversity's sake, or was it more an economic question of, you know, we need to strengthen our local economy? Mm-hmm. These workers are coming in. They are strengthening our local economy, or what?
That's a really, really great question. I think from the faith perspective, faith leaders in the area realized that their congregations were diversifying, and they could either, you know, keep somebody out of a congregation or welcome them into a congregation. And as pastors began to better relate to and know their new Latino families, the Latino community said, we need your help learning English, you know, getting legal status. So what pastors have done is they turn to their Bible. The Bible provides that guidance of how to not just have the conversation, but what is the compass with which you guide your congregation down this path. And then from the business perspective, it was, you know, how does this region stay competitive in a global economy? And that's only if it is a growing and thriving workforce. I'm not saying it was easy. I'm not saying that, you know, it's been all roses in South Carolina, but what has been remarkable is that we've seen a range of conservative faith, law enforcement, business leaders really push in the right direction.
How does that change, you know, you're talking about changing culture first and sort of opening culture first and then changing the politics. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned Colorado and Nevada. Yes, the whole state went for Democrats in the presidential elections, but you look at some of the districts, say the area around La Junta, mm-hmm. that is, you know, in eastern Colorado, that depends on a lot of immigrant labor for agricultural needs. And they probably couldn't do well without that population. But I know that area voted overwhelmingly for Trump and for politicians with anti-immigration philosophies.
So another example is Idaho. So I was in Idaho a couple times over the summer, and I've gotten to know a number of the dairy farmers in Idaho. And, you know, Idaho, southern Idaho, has an unemployment rate of about 3%. It has the third largest dairy industry in the nation. It is a part of the state, if not the country, that, you know, lives and dies on dairy cattle. A number of those, if not the majority of those dairy farmers, voted for President Trump. But they are just as worried about, you know, immigration enforcement, what's going to happen to their workforce, as the Latino community. And it's not because they see that Latino community as, you know, just a cog in the wheel. They saw that Latino community that works with them every day as an extension of their family. So there would be these incredibly powerful conversations where those dairy owners would go from, you know, work one day to then weighing in with their members of delegation, whether it's on refugee resettlement or immigration reform. And they've never done that to the degree that they're doing it now. So it's a very conservative state, but it's leaning in the right direction on this issue.
But still, they voted overwhelmingly for Trump, who was anti-immigration, illegal and undocumented as well. They're voting against their own. This is a what's wrong with Kansas argument. You know, they're voting against their own economic interests. And if you are correct, they're cultural and personal interests.
The human mind is a complicated thing.
My guest today is Ali Narani, the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. He is the author of There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. He'll be speaking on Beyond the Headlines, a conversation about immigration, tonight at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus in a free lecture. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. When you look in the Midwest, there are a number of communities where you see that same sort of spirit you're talking about in Spartanburg. I'm thinking of Guymon, Oklahoma, in the Panhandle, which has had a huge influx of immigration, of Hispanic immigration to work in feedlots, packing companies. Yeah. And you've seen this whole range of reaction from the legal system, the judicial system, schools that are trying or are accommodating this issue. And you also see what started out as fear and trepidation through the changing cultural nature of their community, which is fairly homogenous at one point, to very, very diverse, to seeing it as, wow, this is going to save our town. Because a lot of these small towns, they risk drying up and blowing away if they don't have that labor force.
It's more than labor.
Right, but it's, I mean, labor is a big part of it.
Labor is the core of it. But what comes with labor? What comes with, you know, a person who's working in that feedlot in that cattle farm is somebody who's buying something in a restaurant, whose family is contributing, you know, in multiple ways. So, yes, labor and economic growth is certainly the core of the survival, if not the ability of towns like this to thrive. But it's so much more than just that individual worker, and that's in some ways is what worries me most about the immigration debate today. Is that we are reducing immigrants and immigration to the worker. And there's so much talk about, you know, eliminating family immigration, eliminating chain migration. You know, you think about, you know, my family, you think about families that are across the country who have been here for generations. How many of them bought that first home because the family banded together? Right? So you look at the data over the last 10 years, some of the fastest growth in home purchasing is because of foreign-born residents. I will bet you pretty good money that they were able to buy that home because that immigrant family banded together. And if you don't allow that family to stay together, and you say, you know what, brothers, sisters, siblings, mom, dad, you're not allowed, I think we lose in the long term.
And there have been a lot of proposals about expanding guest worker visas, which allow people to work here, but they don't allow them to bring the family. What do we lose in that equation?
You know, so over the summer, Senators Coburn and Cotton introduced legislation called the RAISE Act. And what the case that they made is that they wanted to slash legal immigration by 50% by drastically reducing family immigration, family-based immigration, and in essence, repurposing those visas to an even smaller number of work-based visas. What we lose as a result are parents and grandparents who are, you know, the childcare. For boys and girls whose parents are out there working. We lose the opportunity of our expanded tax base. We lose the opportunity of people pooling resources to buy property. And we lose the opportunity of more people buying goods and services in a particular town or city. And when you think about the small towns and cities across the middle of the country, that's the kind of economic and social energy that we need.
Now, when you were talking with various communities, did you spend much time, say, in the Midwest, say, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska?
That's going to be the next book. I did spend some time in Indiana. Uh-huh. Got to know Indiana a little bit, spent time there, Utah, Houston.
Did you find places where some of the communities were just saying, you know, I'm not really open for this big a change in my community? I mean, that's sort of the thought of people who oppose a lot of legal or undocumented immigration. It's about, I want to keep my community's identity as whatever it was, and most of that is a homogeneous sort of white community.
That sentiment comes up everywhere. You know, I lived in South Boston for almost 10 years, and it kind of came up there, and that's a part of a big city.
Yeah.
So that dynamic of people kind of wondering about, you know, not wanting their community to change is real. And the way I've been thinking about this is that when it comes to immigration, Americans have come to love the Jose or the Muhammad they know, but they still are afraid of the Jose or Muhammad they don't know. So how do you take that experience of a changing community? And it's hard, it's complicated, it's difficult, it's emotional, but most of the time people fight through it over a period of time. How do you take that experience and extrapolate it to a broader community, a broader population? And that, I think, is a challenge.
Especially during economically challenging times, it even gets worse.
Exactly. And you know, and not just even the economic challenges, but you have fear of terrorism. So all these things really kind of mix together in a really, really tough soup to pick apart.
In our remaining time, my guest today is Ali Noorani, the Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. He will be speaking on Beyond the Headlines, a conversation about immigration, tonight at 7 in Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. He's also the author of There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration, which came out last spring. The other big news in the last couple of weeks has been the Trump revised travel and immigration ban, which kept Libya, Syria, Iran, Yemen, and Somalia on the list. Added Chad, North Korea, and Venezuela, and ended it for the Sudan, and I guess Iraq went off on an earlier revision. So that now it's not all Muslim countries with North Korea and Venezuela. What's your assessment of this immigration ban?
Well, I mean, you know, tourism from North Korea was really becoming a problem. Well, I mean, look at it this way. So the administration has not just the right, but the responsibility to keep the nation secure. The initial versions of the travel ban, we had serious reservations about. We're going through this version, trying to understand and, is it on firm legal ground? I think that ultimately, creating a ban like this sends the wrong message to the country or to the world. I think we can be putting in force these sorts of measures in terms of vetting and making sure that people are going through the right checks without sending a message to the world that we're closed for business. We've talked to far too many hotels, leaders in the tourism industry who, you know, they may not have anybody coming from North Korea, but they're worried about the message that the administration is sending to the world and that, you know, tourists from around the world, businesses from around the world are going to say, you know what, I'm going to go somewhere else.
Well, it's interesting. I really have heard very little reaction in our community, but Tulsa has very strong ties to Venezuela through the oil industry.
But in the Venezuela piece was limited to the leadership of Venezuela and kind of the family leadership. Okay. So that was the slice that the administration is focused on, not Venezuelans writ large or the business community writ large.
Right. Do you think that will pass constitutional muster as far as, you know, because in that case, it's just the leadership. Mm-hmm. It's still mainly Muslim countries.
It depends. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on the radio. the original case that was being made with regards to the first version of the travel ban was around the Establishment Clause. And what was the original intention of President Trump in establishing these bans? This is a proclamation. It's not an executive order. There seems to be a little more diversity. So it's a little too early to tell, if it will pass muster from a legal perspective. We're just more worried right now about the message that's being sent to the rest of the world, because it's having an economic effect. And ultimately, if we're going to do things in the interest of the American worker and their family, we have to have an economy that is connected to the world.
Now, obviously, with DACA and its sort of six-month phase out, I would imagine for your national immigration forum, that's the big issue right now. What is your organization doing to educate lawmakers about, this six-month period? Yep.
So across the country, we have about nearly two dozen organizers who focus on working with faith, law enforcement, business leaders to create public events, meetings with members of Congress, so that ultimately a Republican member of Congress is hearing from their Republican voters. So, somebody in Tulsa, the delegation here is hearing from the folks at the end of the day who are going to vote for them in the primary. Because that's really where, from a political perspective, these members are going to be engaged. How we get those folks engaged, faith, law enforcement, business leaders engaged, is really, again, through their cultural framework, their faith, their public safety expertise, their business expertise. So we're very much very focused on making sure that Republicans are hearing from their voters. And in fact, next week on Thursday, October 5th, we're going to have a national convening of about 200 or 300 conservative leaders from across the country, where actually Senator Tillis from North Carolina is going to be joining us. And that convening is called Leading the Way, A New Approach to American Immigration. And we really want to convey a sense to Congress that there is deep Republican and Democratic support for these issues.
Within the first 9 months of the administration, there's been, at least from ICE, there seems to be more effort on the rules of change of who they're engaging with in the communities, and it's created some fear and uncertainty. Out of that, have you found some new allies that perhaps you didn't have within the last 4 years?
Absolutely. So it's the law enforcement community in particular, I think, has been really, really important. So we work with—
Is this like local law enforcement, federal law enforcement? Or
local.
Yeah.
So we've developed a task force called the Law Enforcement Immigration Task Force. It's about 90 chiefs and sheriffs across the country, from Bakersfield to Boston, Republican to Democrat. And what we found is that they want to be a part of the conversation around immigration policy in a constructive way. Because, every cop on the corner takes an oath to serve and protect their community, the entirety of their community. The only way they can fulfill that oath is if they are not seen as agents of immigration. So there's this tension for local law enforcement where they're on the front lines. They're keeping us safe. And they know that unless the immigrant community is reporting crimes, they can't do their job. So we've seen allies come, surface from the faith community, from law enforcement, from business, from the veterans community. And I just think this is both a challenging time for the country, but also a really exciting time. Because, when it comes to immigration, more people than ever are paying attention.
All right. Ali Noorani, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Ali Noorani is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum and the author of There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. You'll be speaking on Beyond the Headlines, a conversation about immigration, tonight at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. That lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.